podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Well, what a start to the best of series. We've had Wasim Akram, we've had Robert Craddock, and now we have one of the best T20 cricketers of this generation, Dan Christian. I spoke to him in April 2022, around the time he released his Player's Diary with Gideon Haigh. Enjoy. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Menna's Masterclass. On this episode, I'm joined by Australian all-rounder Dan Christian. Dan made his debut for New South Wales all the way back in 2006 and has represented Australia in 20 one-day internationals and 23 T20 internationals. Dan has made his name as a trailblazing T20 professional all around the world, winning 9 T20 titles, including 2 with the Sydney Sixers. He has now written a book called The All-Rounder with Gideon Haigh, where he documents a year in the life of a professional T20 cricketer. The links to buy the book are in the show notes. I hope you enjoy this interview with Dan Christian. Dan, welcome to Cricket Unfiltered. We're huge fans of you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my co-host Paul Dennett, who's not here today, we at one stage were going to suggest maybe you take a restraining order out on him because he was just obsessed with you all of 2021. So, yeah, he's thrilled you're on the show. He couldn't be here today. But, yeah, I'm glad you could come on to talk about your new book, The All-Rounder, which you co-wrote with Gideon Haigh. You must be really proud of it.
Yeah, it's come out pretty well. It was a really interesting exercise for me. I'd never thought I'd do anything like this at any stage. So, but when Gideon got in touch, it was a really easy process. Just speaking to Gideon every couple of days for the 12 months or so, and just talking about what I was up to, talking about the matches I was playing in, and then getting into some in-depth analysis of those at different stages. But then the crazy year that I had in and out of bubbles and isolation and then leading into the birth of my first child. So, yeah, pretty extraordinary 12 months.
Yeah, a great 12 months to document. And I noticed that you actually didn't come up with the idea to write a book. It was Gideon that approached you, and he wrote that, you know, he documented Ed Cowan's Sheffield Shield season about 10 years ago, and he wanted to get an insight into a modern cricketer. And I don't think he could have got, a better example. What was it like when Gideon first came to you with the idea?
I was a little bit reluctant, just because I don't know. Like I said, I've never had an interest in sort of doing a book or documenting what I get up to, I guess. But we talked about it. Originally started off as just an IPL diary, and then the IPL itself, that first IPL was extraordinary, really, the way we just kept playing through, 400,000 cases a day in India, and that whole experience of then trying to get out of the country and with our borders closed in Australia, and it only went for 4 weeks or so, and the way things were panning out, we decided to extend it to the whole 12 months, and yeah, it ended up being a really cool experience.
Did you enjoy that process of kind of reflecting regularly on what was going on? I mean, I'm not someone that, say, keeps a journal or a diary, so I would find it quite, strange to that. How did you find it?
Yeah, and I'd never done that before either. I've never written a diary or had a journal or anything like that. So it was, I guess, just being able to sit down like this and speak to Gideon every day every two or three days on Zoom was... It just became part of my routine, I guess. There were different stages. Obviously, when you're having it, you have a bad day or whatever, it gets a bit monotonous and you're like, well, I haven't really done anything. I don't really got nothing to talk about. But then we'd just start talking about random things, whether it was, what golf courses I'd been playing the last couple of days or how Georgia was going with the pregnancy, or we might get into some tactical talks about what I've been thinking leading into games or after games or things that I'd seen other players do. So it was the way that Gideon ran it and ran the process and sort of guided me through the process made it really, really easy. And it was from my perspective, it was pretty cool.
I mean, there's some fantastic insights in the book. You didn't have your filter on, that's for sure. So, a lot of great stuff in there. I sort of was thinking, you know, it's a great time for you to do this because, you know, you started your career back in 2006. So, you know, you're writing it 15 years after beginning and you've done everything. I mean, I don't need to tell you, but, you know, won Shields, played it for Australia. You know, you're not just a T20 cricketer. You've lived a full cricketer's life. You know, and I sort of was thinking about Victoria dumping you at the age of 34, and then I was watching Sean Marsh running around for WA at 39, and I just wonder if you sort of feel like, you know, maybe you should have been given a few more years at first-class level.
At the time, yeah, I was really disappointed. I felt I still had plenty of good cricket in me, and looking back now, I definitely could have had a couple more years, I think. You know, the last probably 3 years has been I've played my best cricket, and I think a lot of guys will. That's no surprise that Sean's still doing well for Western Australia. All those years of experience, and you know, if you're still fit, then it makes perfect sense that you're still going to be doing well. So just because you've been in those situations, you've been in all those pressure situations, and you're probably not as well, you know, near as affected by that pressure as you would when you're a younger player. So yeah, I would have liked to have kept going in Shield cricket for a little bit longer. But that's okay. By not playing, I've got the opportunity to play a bit more 2020 and, travel around the world. And my, I suppose, my T20 stocks in that time have you know, gone back up. So, yeah, silver lining, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I just think from a practical point of view, you know, that it's so important in Australian cricket that the knowledge of experienced players gets passed on to younger players. So sometimes I think if you maybe move a player on too early, you kind of lose that knowledge. It doesn't get fed back into the playing group and the system, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. That's one thing I think I touched on it in the book. One thing I think England do really well, England retain older players a lot more than what Australia do. And I look back to when I was growing up and coming through the first class system in New South Wales, I had guys like Simon Cattich, Stuart Clark, Matthew Nicholson. Brad Haddin was still young then. He hadn't played for Australia yet, but he was a senior guy in that squad. Greg Mail, guys like this that had played a lot of first-class cricket with a lot of good players, and they were the guys I was doing most of my learning off. And I feel like these days we just don't have as many sort of older guys that hang around here in Australian cricket. But we get that. You get it a lot over in England. That's one thing I think England do really well.
Yeah, also I guess T20 cricket is a bit of an old man's game. You know, you see yourself and Socky and some of the older blokes running around still. Did you find that when you could sort of shift focus just onto your T20 game, you know, you could really develop that area, your power hitting, your variations, that kind of thing?
Definitely, yeah. That was the best thing about going to just 2020 cricket and being able to structure my training that way and be able to work on, as you say, just my power hitting and trying to really develop that side of it. Always been a decent kind of slogger, but actually putting that extra time into developing my swing coupled with, you know, just a bit more batting experience, I think it helped me quite a bit. And likewise with my variations, just trying to work on your different kind of slower balls and then just spending the time on perfecting those rather than bowling, you know, half a dozen of them at training and then, you know, the next thing you've got a red ball in your hand and you're just trying to hit the top of off stump for, you know, as long as possible. So, mind you, I still do a bit of that. I still do a little bit of that longer form style of bowling just to keep the body ticking over, really. But in terms of being able to develop my variations and get to a stage where your execution is good enough to perform in a pressure situation, then yeah, that being able to just focus on it's been brilliant.
Where do you do that longer style of bowling?
Yeah, generally I'll go to, in England, for example, I'm doing it at, I'll just go to Notts' red ball training. So when I get there in early May, I've got about a month until my first game. So I'll just train I'll do my own batting stuff on the side and I'll bowl with a red ball at them at training for, 6, 7, 8 overs just to get the K's in the legs and the overs under my belt, and then I'll do my variation, and it's like target practice, I suppose I'd call it, on the side.
I had Shane Watson on here last year, and he said that he was playing grade cricket and he was just slogging after a few balls to get ready for T20 leagues. And boy, did I feel sorry for those grade bowlers, Watto winding up at you after a few seeds.
Yeah, exactly. It was nice to get back and play. I played a few club games at Uni New South Wales before the Big Bash this year. So that was good. And I did the same thing last year as well. It's been nice to get back. Now that I'm back living in Sydney, it's been nice to get back to my old club, and there's still a lot of familiar faces around there. Back playing in my old ground and some of the old grounds I grew up playing on. So it was it's been nice to get back there too.
Yeah, I commentate on the Kings Grove Sports T20 Cup, so I'm well aware of that competition. And it's actually, you know, one thing that blows me away about it is that it really is a feeder into franchises. Like, you know, I sort of, you know, chatting to the young kids there and the up and comers, you know, you're not far away if you do well at that level to getting a gig for the Sixers or the Thunder or one of the clubs.
Yeah, well, definitely this year, given the the circus we had with COVID and, so many guys missing out on games. You know, there was a game the Stars played, and there must have been maybe eight club players in that Stars team. So, as you say, you're not far away, and a couple of those guys did really well, and it just goes to show how great the structure of our competition is, I guess, the grade competition in the country that guys can come in and be ready to go.
Daniel Sams played in the final of the Kings Road Sports T20 Cup, and then, you know, a couple of days ago was at the IPL bowling to the best in the world. So, yeah, it's a really great experience for those young players. Gideon Hay wrote that you were sort of very level-headed. You know, you're quite a level-headed guy, and that's, you know, what I've seen over the years covering you. But, you know, reading the book, I mean, you were thrown so many challenges this year, off the field, on the field, quarantines, you know, and then you sort of add into the fact that you know, had your first child, you bought a house from the other side of the world. I'm just wondering, you know, how you managed to maintain that sort of level-headed nature, or how challenging it was to sort of cope with all that.
Don't get me wrong, I have my times when things are feeling like they're pretty difficult, but I guess I just always try and look at what's next, and try not to spend too much time thinking about what's just happened. So it's probably one of the mental skills, I guess, that's made me good at 2020 cricket, to know that if you're going to have your failures in 2020 cricket, and you just got to get back on the horse and trust that whatever you've been practicing or whatever you've done in the past has worked for you, and it just sort of keeps you in that frame of mind to still think you're going to have some success. So I guess I use a lot of those skills in life, really, knowing that, you know, if there's something that's difficult, whatever it may be it that we're on the other side of the world or that we're in a quarantine, then, you know, you kind of just try and keep looking forward, I guess, and try and grab the and just try and pull whatever positive there is in that situation, and just try and focus on that, really.
When you're in tough times, is there anything in particular you do? Do you talk to someone? Is it your partner maybe that you lean on? What's sort of your way of getting through tough times?
Yeah, she's really good. Georgia's fantastic to talk to about anything like that. She's been great for me in the last 12 months. And, yeah, just family, friends, if it's – and probably just trying to focus on if something's – whatever it might be, if cricket's not going really well, then I might try and focus on my golf, or I'll focus on family or whatever it is. Just try and switch off whatever that is and put my energy energy and positive thoughts, I guess, into something else.
It's working, because you were throwing a few curveballs last year. It would certainly drive a few people crazy. I mean, I just found it like basically, you know, you're trying to sort of, you're buying flats and you're doing all this stuff from the other side of the world, locked in a hotel room. I mean, I know the internet's pretty good now, but, you know, I'd still like to sort of look at a flat if I was going to buy it.
Yeah, the internet kind of has to be good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that was the beauty of just finding a, particularly buying a house. Chatting to Pat Cummins was the one that helped me the most with that. I ran into him in the IPL, and he just used a buyer's agent, and she was brilliant for him. Did all the did all the open inspections for him on FaceTime or Zoom, and yeah, she did all the background checks on the house for him. And so yeah, I ended up getting her number, and she helped us out with that. Purchase, which was awesome, and wouldn't have been able to do it without her. So that was a really handy process.
Your budget was a bit lower than Pat's.
Considerably lower than Pat's, yeah. I would have been able to buy Pat's letterbox, I reckon, with my budget. the house that he ended up in. That was really handy. It was I'll definitely be using that again. It makes made the process very, very seamless.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I love the insight in the diary to all those things, because, you know, we just, you know, I mean, I cover cricket, so I see a bit more, but, you know, most of us just see what you do on the field. We, you know, hear little bits, but we don't get a sort of real sort of window into all that, like, life admin stuff that doesn't stop just because you're a professional cricketer or playing in the PSL or the IPL. You know, you still got stuff to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose that's one of the beauties of just playing 2020. You're only training a couple of hours a day, or your games are at night time, so you got your whole day to get on top of your life admin, I guess. Sometimes I'm not great at it. Sometimes I let it go and end up with 1,000 things to do in a day and get a bit stressed about having to do all of that. But yeah, it's generally pretty easy to stay on top of.
Oh, that's good to hear. You know, you wrote that the last Sydney Sixers title in 2021 was one of your favourite T20 wins. I think it was your ninth T20 title, and you had 4 days to celebrate. And I actually commentated on a great game the next day after that, and Jack Edwards turned up, but having not had any sleep, made 90-odd. Yeah. So he did okay. But, yeah, I mean, that just seemed like a great win. I think it was the Sydney's second win on a row in a row. So, yeah, just take us into what it's like when, you know, you win a title like that and you can celebrate.
Yeah, it was nice. That was a bit different to a lot of the others, because a lot of the others, you're generally on a plane off somewhere to play your next thing, or if it's been blasts or the big bash competitions I've won in the past, it's the guys have ended up going back to Shield cricket pretty much straight away. So whereas last year there was a good break after it, and we got to spend some time together as a team out of a bubble. We were in a bubble for the whole season, so we had sort of 4 days to break this bubble and spend some time together and just be normal, which was awesome. And the other comps I've played overseas, you're generally on a plane home the next day as well, because you've got something else on. So yeah, it was nice to spend that time together and just reflect a bit and just let our hair down and not have to worry about being in bubbles or you know, having to fly anywhere. It was a really nice couple of days for us.
Yeah, that's good. And then it sort of contrasted with the most recent Big Bash and where the sort of diary ends. That, you know, how challenging the latest Big Bash was with the sort of restrictions. It seemed even more onerous than last season, where you were sort of put in couples and very small groups. So you'd really want to make sure you're in the right small group there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I got kind of lucky with that, because I had Georgia and Harper had just been born. So I had them. They were my travel buddies for the 6 weeks or so, or 8 weeks, however long it went for. It was a difficult season. It certainly challenged your love for the game this year, having to go through what we went through. And it just felt like at different stages, it felt like we were animals in the circus, really, and you were just getting packed up and you moved on to the next show. So it was, nowhere near as enjoyable as it has been in the past, but I'm glad we got it done. I'm glad we got it finished. I'm glad we were still able to put a show on for the fans, I guess, as disappointing as it was to get to the final and then lose it. To looking back, I guess it was a pretty amazing performance from us to just get there. I think given the players that we lost throughout the season, we had 4 or 5 guys playing through injury in the final, plus the COVID outs, and yeah, it was a pretty crazy year.
Yeah, an extraordinary preliminary final at the SCG where Hayden Kerr led you guys into the final against all the odds. And then, like, I just felt the whole sort of tournament was strange, you know, Steve Smith not being able to play at the end. It just seemed as a fan sort of hard to follow what was going on. And, you know, I read in the book that you sort of felt like you know, you were just sort of being wheeled out for the money by the end. Just let's get this TV money and get it over and done with. You know, have you given a lot? Has the ACA asked for a lot of feedback about that in the wake of the BBL?
Yeah, they did. They send out every year. They send out a survey for us, and it's pretty thorough. You talk about absolutely everything. You talk about the travel. You talk about the food at the ground, accommodation, standard of facilities at the ground, like, you know, what the training nets are like, scheduling, the whole box and dice. So in the past, you normally just sort of tick a box and rarely write anything in the comments, but yeah, spent a bit more time on the one this year. And I dare say everyone was in a majority of the players were in a pretty similar boat, I think, but just talking about the difficulties of it, of the year. But I mean, it was like, what do you do? We were going through this third wave of COVID cases. And of course you can understand, we want to get the competition. Like, guys want to play cricket, and
cricket needs the money.
And cricket needs the money. Exactly right. So, and it's at the end of the day, it's our job to get out there and play. So if, you know, I suppose you just got to suck it up and get on with it at different times. And unfortunately those times aren't going to be as enjoyable and as normal, but yeah, it's just what we're going to do, I guess.
Hopefully the next Big Bash summer is not so COVID affected.
Definitely, yeah.
Do you have any, you know, everyone has their theories about how to fix the Big Bash. I sort of lean towards maybe just trimming a couple of games so we can get more stars in. But I think mainly, and you sort of document it when you're talking about other comps, Australia just needs our best players playing in it first. We can't expect the other players from around the world to come and play in our comp when, you know, our top 15 players aren't playing in it.
Yeah, agree. That's I don't know how we're going to do that. I think it's got to be something like the one day or the international one days and the international T20s just need to get pushed back to maybe the end of February, middle to the end of February. And then once the test series is finished, all the Australian players play the back end of the Big Bash. I think that's probably the easiest solution, I think, in terms of getting those guys available. We can play the start of the Big Bash as we do now, where all of the Australian white ball players are available and, you know, you get through it like that. But yeah, to be able to have, you know, Steve Smith and Pat Cummins and Mitchell Starc and David Warner and these guys playing the finals of the Big Bash would be massive. It'd be huge for us as a competition. Better for the fans at the moment. You sense that the fans feel like the competition's too drawn out, and it just gets a bit, oh, here's another Big Bash game. Oh, still going, is it still? I can't believe it's still going. It's been going for ages. But you roll out those guys at the end of the comp, and, you know, it just gives a bit more excitement, renews that interest in the competition, I think. And yeah, it'd be much better for it, I think.
Your fans aren't stupid. They know then when their best players aren't playing. And like, I just remember being at the SCG a couple of years ago, and Josh Hazlewood was bowling to Aaron Finch. I think Finchie made 100, and, you know, he stepped back and just hit one over cover for six off Hazlewood. And you're like, this is what the Big Bash should be about. You know, the best Australian cricketers taking each other on. So yeah, hopefully those things happen. I agree with you. I think after the Sydney test, just get them in to the comp. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Menna's Masterclass. I'm Menna's and I'm here with Dan Christian. So standard-wise, would you say it's kind of the IPL, the Pakistan Super League, and then you probably got the Big Bash and the CPL and the Blast all about the same?
Yeah, I used to think the BBL was right up there, but it's certainly dropped off the last few years, and I think that's the quality of overseas players is not as high anymore, and we're just not getting access to the Australian players anymore. So yeah, I think it's dropped off quite a bit. And going around the world, I think we're the only competition that doesn't have our local internationals playing. So our Australian players playing, the West Indies players all play theirs, the Indians all play theirs. The English guys, I suppose, with the Blast and the 100, they don't get to play. So I guess that's where they've got that challenge with us in terms of scheduling and having those guys available. But yeah, every other big competition has their big guns playing in it, and that's the big draw card for for fans and fans and sponsors and TV, I guess.
Mm.
So the as long as we can, if we can get those guys playing, I think it'll be huge for the Big Bash.
Are you playing in the Big Bash next year? I'm not sure. Are you still under contract?
I am still under contract, yeah. So pretty keen to get back into it. This year was pretty draining. So I certainly wouldn't be making any decisions around playing on based on what we've just gone through. Yeah, my body's still good, still loving it, still trying to get better, and I still want to win competitions. So I'm off to England again in a month's time. So keen to get back over to Notts. This will be my eighth season at Notts, which will be pretty cool. Hopefully stay for the 100 drafts in the next few days. So hopefully I'll get a gig there and then maybe CPL and then, yeah, back for the Big Bash. So I guess the circus rolls on.
Exactly. Will you take Georgia and Harper with you to England?
Yeah, they're coming over. So that'll be nice. They're, we're looking forward to that. We're getting Harper's passport sorted as we speak, sent her off for photos, got photos of her the other day. We had to hold her up and she had a little head. So that was pretty cute. yeah, they're really looking forward to going over as well. And, Georgia is. Harper obviously hasn't told me whether she wants to go or not.
This is when you look at those passport photos in a few years and, Harper will be like 3 or 4 and totally different and you've still got this baby photo.
Yeah.
What about you? One thing that you said in the book was that you've enjoyed all your sort of teammates, that you've made a lot of good friends playing cricket. And, you sort of said you actually haven't been many dickheads that you played with, that, you've been really lucky with your teammates. And, any particular guys you're really good friends with and sort of, I guess, what's the challenge of, flying in and out of teams and still keeping those relationships?
Yeah, I think just generally I think cricket's a great sport for that. I haven't played any other professional sports, so I can't comment on those, I guess. But cricket seems to be a great sport for filtering out the dickheads. You just don't seem to have them. They don't seem to last. So you end up, I've made lots of friends over at Notts. I've spent a lot of time with guys like Harry Gurney and Alex Hales, Luke Fletcher, Stephen Mullaney, Michael Lum, these sort of guys that I've spent lots of time with and keep in touch with and play golf with whenever we can or catch up for dinner whenever we can. I caught up the other day with Cameron White, who I played a lot of cricket with. We played under-19s cricket together and then we played a lot of cricket together at
Victoria
and then the Renegades. And then, you've just got guys everywhere. I went down to South Australia last month and we celebrated a 10-year reunion of our 2012 Ryobi Cup win. So went to Callum Ferguson's house and, caught up with him and Theo Dorópolis and Dan Harris, Cameron Borges, all these guys that I played with back then. So it is a great sport for that. And that is one of the beauties of playing in so many teams. You just get to know guys from all over the place and it's with WhatsApp and social media, it's pretty easy to maintain those relationships to a certain extent, but then it's also great to catch up with them when you can.
Yeah, there's a great photo in the book of you and Moses sitting in the IPL and you're in different teams at that stage. And, I think the caption is, we're often teammates, but this time we're opponents or something like that. I mean, that's just the life of modern cricketing. You train with Moses, I think, all that off-season and then I think he got you out in the IPL.
Yeah, he did, yeah. Yeah, first ball too, the bugger. Yeah, that's been another great thing about coming back to the Sixes. I played some underage stuff not some underage stuff with Moses because he was too young, but I think we played Colts cricket together. I was 21, he was 16, something like that. And being able to come back and we played for New South Wales together and when the 2020 first started too. And, yeah, being able to come back to New South Wales and play for the Sixes and be reunited, I guess, with him. We just live around the corner from each other too, so we play golf a lot together. Yeah, go for coffees, whatever. So it's nice. But I guess it's it can be a weird experience when you meet each other on the other side of the world and you end up having to play against each other. It's I think in that game, he marked centre for me that game too because the umpire was off changing the ball or something like that and he was at the top of his mark. And so I just asked him for centre and he gave me centre. Yeah, and then he got me out first ball. So it was a pretty funny game.
I bet you had a few laughs about it. Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm curious, you're sort of in this modern generation of, you know, actually getting paid quite a bit of money to play for certain teams. And even, I think it was 2011, that first IPL auction where you went for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And I just wonder sort of, you know, if you're talking, what you'd say to a young player, you know, that's coming up and maybe they get a big contract. You know, you see it all the time. You know, young Aussies, they have a great big bash and then they get chucked $500,000 to play in the IPL. Now, what's your advice to young players, how to deal with that? Because, you know, you've been doing it for 10 years. You know, how do you handle being the star and all that weight of expectation?
That's probably the thing I struggled with the most in those first couple of IPLs. I've never done that well at the IPL. I had one year where I did okay and we just lost the final when I played at Pune. Had a decent season there. But apart from that, I've never done that well. And I think particularly at the beginning, I struggled with the expectation that came with the price tag. That was the toughest thing. I put my name into that auction for $50,000 and ended up going for $900,000. So I suppose my own opinion of my ability at that stage was only, you know, that I was a 50 grand sort of player and, you know, might be on the fringes a bit. And then next thing you know, you're one of the highest played players in the comp and all those eyes are on you. And I couldn't handle it. Didn't play well. I probably didn't handle it emotionally or mentally either. I struggled with the stress and the pressure of it. So that's probably the biggest thing I try and say to a younger player that is in that environment, that the price tag, just to try your best to ignore that price tag and the pressure that comes along with it. It's pretty hard to do, particularly when you're in a fishbowl like the IPL and you get so much, there is so much criticism, I guess, of your performance, particularly on social media. That's probably the toughest part of it. You get abused nonstop over there, no matter what you do. So that's probably the hardest thing to handle. And then commentators have got to critique what you do as well. That's one of the other things that you've got to come to terms with. And it's not always going to be favourable. They're just trying to give an opinion on what you're doing and how your team's going. And if you're not going well, then unfortunately you just got to cop it. So yeah, probably trying to manage the expectations and the pressure that you put on yourself is probably the toughest thing.
Yeah, well, it seems like you've certainly got it under control now, after, you know, 19-20 titles later.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I have got it completely under control. There are still times when it's pretty tough. The last IPL was pretty tough. I didn't play very well, despite feeling like I went into the competition in some really decent form. I did okay. Did okay for Australia in that West Indies and Bangladesh series, so I felt like I was in a pretty good place and hitting the ball really well, but I just got in one of those 2020 ruts that you can get in where things just happen. You know, I got run out, and got out first ball a couple of times, and you just sort of get in a little bit of a spiral in the format, and sometimes it's hard to break it. But as we spoke about, I guess at the start, the key for me is just trying to think about the next game. It's one of the beauties of 2020. You've always got another game, you know, 2 days' time. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the fickleness of the support that you get too, they very, very quickly change their opinion of you when you hit a six or you get a wicket or you take a good catch or something, and all of a sudden you're a great player again. So, yeah, being able to manage that, it can be tough, but it's probably the key to making sure that you still play well.
Yeah, I mean, Indian cricket fans are so crazy. Like they'll pick up one little ball you bowl and why did you bowl a slower ball there, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's incredible. When you sort of, you write in the book about, and this is one of the real insights that I found interesting, that, you know, the modern T20 cricket, they get more games, so lots more opportunities, as you say, get onto the next game. But some of the opportunities are like constricted. Like, for example, you go out to bat and you got to start slogging from the first ball. It's like, you know, if you're playing sort of first class cricket and you get in a run of outs, you go out there and you might think, I'll just take my time for 15, 20 minutes. You just, you know, settle things down. But in T20 cricket, you just don't have that luxury.
No, particularly in the role that I play where you're coming in towards the end, it can be quite tough, can be really tough. If the game situation needs you to particularly go out and try and hit boundaries from ball one. But I think that's from a personal perspective, if you've got a good supportive coaching staff and a good supportive team around you that know that that's your role, you can deal with, I guess, missing out a few times, knowing that you're going out trying to do whatever the team needs.
Mm. What was it like then, you know, at the end of your career, you get called into the Australian squad last year, you know, Bangladesh or West Indies Bangladesh tour, sort of leading into what was the T20 World Cup. I mean, you know, it sort of must have come out of nowhere a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. But I still harboured that desire to get back there. George Bailey and I played in that same under-19s team with Cameron White. So George and I have been mates for a long, long time, played a bit together at the Hurricanes as well, played against each other a lot, obviously. So when he got that job as chairman of selectors, he was fantastic. He got in touch pretty much straight away and said, look, you're still in our plans, you're still in our thoughts. I don't care how old you are. If you're playing well, then you're going to be considered. So, yeah, that was nice. That was really nice for him to reach out that way. And it meant that I still had that carrot, I guess, of what might happen if I was playing well. So, yeah, to get that opportunity was brilliant. I jumped at it. Obviously, it was a unique opportunity, given that a lot of the first choice guys were pulling out of that tour. They weren't going to be around due to, you know, bubble fatigue and a few injuries, that kind of thing. So, yeah, still great to get back there and get that chance. It was a pretty tough tour. We didn't play very well. We got beaten by the West Indies and then got beaten by Bangladesh.
Not good pitches.
No, they were shocking. They were shocking. The pitches in the West Indies were pretty good. They were much better. I mean, they played some brilliant cricket in that series, the West Indies. They had a really good side out and played really, really well. But Bangladesh, I'd never played on pitches like that where 100 was a good score. If you bowled well, they were getting 90 out of 120 balls, which is extraordinary. Crazy. That it could be that difficult, but it was, and it was. I think the last game we played that we lost, I think I played as the second quick, I think, and we went Nathan Ellis and myself, and then just went all spin, and both Nathan Ellis and myself just bowled slow balls every ball. We didn't bowl one on pace ball. It was just completely different cricket. Unfortunately, it just took us a little while to adapt to that and actually start doing that until late in the tour. But great to be back there. Great to be back involved in the top level again. Got the opportunity to go to the World Cup, and was pretty difficult decision to pull out of that World Cup. But given what was happening back at home and the potential for 2 weeks of quarantine at that stage, and yeah, I just didn't want to miss the birth of. Didn't want to miss Harper's berth or risk missing Harper's berth. So, yeah, pulled out.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were going to be one of the three reserve players. And, you know, Justin Langer, I think there's a bit in the diary where you say, you know, Justin Langer sort of tried to sweet talk you into going over as being one of the experienced players and someone that, you know, could be a leader off the field, even if you weren't in the squad. But, yeah, that's a tough one for you who'd been travelling for so long to make that commitment when you probably weren't going to play.
Yeah, that was the thing. That was part of the decision as well. If I was going to be in the 11, then, you know, it's a different conversation, I think. But as a reserve player for the squad of 15, it meant that, you know, someone in the team had to get injured or you know, miss out through COVID. And then someone else had to miss out or get injured. Mm. We're in the original squad just for me to get added to the original squad and then, you know, potentially be in the team. So while it would have been a fantastic experience and I would have jumped at it at any other stage in my life, yeah, I guess the priorities change a little bit when you got a bub on the way, or particularly first bub. So yeah, I had to pull out, and it was the right decision. Still think it was the right decision. Although it would have been great to be a part of those celebrations.
Yeah, they looked like they had a good time.
Won that final. But, yeah, that's probably the only regret.
I'm sure the guy you gave your spot to was pretty happy.
Yeah, exactly. The guys, yeah, they look like they had a fantastic time. And, yeah, good on them. Well done.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating bits of the diary was your insight into the setup of the Australian team, because, you know, you hadn't been there for so long, but, you know, you'd jail had coached you, and you document a pretty harrowing session he put you through about 10 years ago up in the Northern Territory. So it's a great bit of the book. But, you know, I just, you know, I guess what's sort of your take on, you know, what the team was like under JL?
Oh, look, from my experience in that, on that trip, you could tell there was some tension there that had been building for, I don't know, who knows how long. And it was more just around the way that the guys were handling JL, I guess, and the way that he goes about his coaching, or the way that he'd been going about his coaching, I guess. I know there was they had their big review in June or July or whenever it was, I think maybe May, before we went on that trip. And they all gave their feedback about each other. And then they went through the process of trying to put those recommendations, I guess, into place on that West Indies and Bangladesh trip. It always got on really well with JL. Had a lot of respect for him as a player growing up and watching him. Loved watching him bat, and you know what he did in as a player, and then as a coach, he was the kind of coach that I think he's brilliant at. You see him in different teams. He's brilliant at coming in and changing a culture, if you like, where things might have gotten a bit complacent and guys weren't working as hard as they should have. And he comes in and he's all about hard work. He's all about busting your backside at training and doing the work in the gym, and so that when you get out on the field, it's easy. So your net sessions are always, guys are going like flat out, you're getting bounced, it's hard work, and you're doing lots of running before. Your fielding sessions are basically disguised running sessions, so they're pretty tough. And you know, it makes sense in a lot of ways that you know, if you're working that hard at training, then it's going to be easy on the field, like I said. So that style, like I said, is great for, I think, changing a culture, but I reckon that can get a bit draining after a while, and I feel like that's probably where the players were at that stage. For me, coming in for my first tour for, you know, 10 years or 7 years or whatever it had been, in the one-day setup, but yeah, a few years in the 2020, but yeah, it's you know, it was okay for me. Mm-hmm. I was fine with it, but I guess the guys that have been around there for a little while, you can understand that it had started to get a bit draining.
Yeah, you wrote after coming out of like a culture meeting that I think you said, or you thought, you know, culture was just about being a good bloke and playing good cricket. But I guess I can see how those things can be challenged, especially at the top level with the pressure and all the external stuff, can actually challenge that being a good bloke bit. Like,
yeah, I guess. And you've also got to, I suppose you've got to take into account that the bubbles and isolation and all that kind of stuff that guys have had to go through for the last 2 years can test your relationships with people, I guess. Not being able to have the release of going to catch up with your family and your friends outside of games, and just being constantly with each other the whole time. And if there's any kind of, you know, someone's got something, you've got whatever going on in your life, it can be, that's your only outlet, those guys that are around you. And if you know, I suppose it can be easy to test those relationships, I guess, at different stages. So yeah, I can't really comment on exactly what those guys were going through and over that 2 years, but yeah, you can understand why some of those relationships got a bit stretched.
I mean, you know, pretty ballsy of you at one point when you weren't selected in the Aussie side to send some domestic stats to the coach, JL, at the time. But, you know, JL seemed like he just, you know, took it easy, you know, it seemed, you know, and then he picked you, and there's document, you know, you document him sending you, you know, some great messages after you did well. So it seemed like you and he had a healthy relationship.
Yeah, we did, and we do. And it seems to be that there's a real mutual respect there. It certainly feels like there is from my perspective. So, and I've always been, I say that George kept in contact with me, you know, leading into that, but JL did as well. He'd call me every now and then, see how I was going, and say that I was, you know, still on the radar. And he was someone that I could talk to. I felt comfortable talking to him and telling him that I feel like I can help the team in this way, and I can play, you know, play this role or do this job for the team. at whatever stage it might be. So, yeah, he was always great to be able to have that conversation, and you know, he was always really open to it.
Yeah, I mean, just congratulations on the book, Dan. It's so good. You know, I recommend it to all the listeners out there that are into cricket. You know, it's a great insight. And, you know, the links are in the show notes for everyone listening, so you can go and buy a copy. What a combination, you and Gideon Hay, you know. Couldn't get asked for any better. I guess I just want to end on there's some really beautiful stuff there about your Aboriginal heritage and how much it means to you. You talk about the stickers. Was it Emma designed that you put on your bat, and Annika Leroy now uses them, the young women's player, and sort of document how important that was to you and the tour you took in, I think, 2018, was it?
Yeah. It's just something I guess it's something I have always been proud of, and it I suppose as you get older, you get the confidence to be able to express that pride. And I just loved how I love the direction that our sports or society is going, but our sport in particular, in being able to celebrate our Indigenous culture. Ash Gardner does it brilliantly now. It was great to see Scott Boland get that opportunity during the summer and do so well, particularly in that Boxing Day test, and to win that Johnny Muller medal. That was fairy tale stuff. That was fantastic. But yeah, those two guys, both Scott and Ash, you know, flying the flag, I guess, from that perspective. And yeah, Ash in particular is brilliant at it. She's just bringing out her own. She's doing her own artwork, and she's bringing out her own bed linen now with, you know, her own designs on it. So it's brilliant to see that as a sport that we can give people those kinds of opportunities, and you know, hopefully I've been able to play some small role in that, and you know, that some young kids somewhere can take up the sport. Some young Aboriginal kids can take up the sport, and make sure that they're still proud of where they come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's really inspirational. And do you think Cricket Australia's, they seem to be doing better in the last few years at connecting with the Aboriginal community?
Much better, yeah, much better. It's probably the last, five, six, 7 or 8 years where you know, things have gotten a lot better. They've a Reconciliation Action Plan with and had a lot of different people working on that. And, yeah, I think it's great. We see it in every other sport. You know, you have the there's a real celebration of both the Indigenous players and Indigenous culture, both in the AFL and the NRL in particular. And cricket's been a bit late to the party, but we're now at the party. So it's, fantastic from my perspective that we're now getting there.
Good. And, yeah, a great message also in the book around the BLM, Black Lives Matter issue, where you know, you just sort of almost implore the Australian team to be conscious of the issues of countries they're touring or visiting. And I thought Australia probably got caught on the hop with the BLM stuff in 2021. I don't think we handled it particularly well. We probably should have taken a knee in England and been a bit more on the front foot in the Australian summer. But you know, I thought that was a really important message, just that we should be aware of the social issues in the countries we visit.
Yeah, I think so. It's that was one of the things we spoke about on that tour in the West Indies. And yeah, I think it's a really easy thing to do. If you go to someone's house and they want you to take your shoes off, then you take your shoes off. Like it's the same kind of thing. It's just respecting what other people other people's desires and or you know whatever they're going through issues at that stage. And yeah, and unless you feel overly strongly about, you know, going against that, then why not just do it? It's not a hard thing. Kneeling's not a hard thing to do. And it just shows support for you know, particularly that West Indies team when we're over there. It shows support of the issues that those guys are going through. It's just not a hard, just don't think it's a hard thing to do and a big deal. I don't think it's a big deal to support it. Just something really easy for us to do and you know, it just helps create that awareness and you know, shows that you're respectful of other people's, what other people's issues are.
Yeah, I mean, well said. And I think it's a great way to end our interview, Dan, because, you know, I think Australian cricket's really lucky to have you and your contribution is immense. And, you know, I think this book, The All-Rounder, will, you know, be really important. And, you know, you sort of look at the way Ed's diary is looked back as being important. I think this will be as well. So congratulations and hope it does really well.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, Menace. Cheers.
Oh, terrific to talk to Dan. He's such a lovely bloke, and what a great insight into the life of a modern cricketer. I'll be back soon with another Menna's Masterclass. Thanks for listening, and if you can rate and review the podcast, I'd be much appreciated. Take care.
Sports Social Podcast Network.